Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by The New York Times' James Poniewozik. He is the TV critic over there. One of the TV. You guys have multiple. You are a big enough operation. You have multiple critics of various sorts, right?
We have scads of critics, yes, including three, depending how you define it, TV critics. We got myself. We got Mike Hale. Who has been doing that for a while. And we have Margaret Lyons, who does our watching newsletter.
Yeah. And also the author of Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America, which I have been dipping back into over the last couple of weeks here. As I was just saying to James before the show started, it's so much fun to get to do all this over again, four more years. But we might talk about that a little bit at the end. But the reason we're here today is to talk about the 50th anniversary of an American institution, Saturday Night Live, which I don't know if you're a Peacock subscriber, you can't get away from the SNL celebration. It's all over that app. I've been kind of going through the various documentaries, but the biggest thing, of course, was the 2.5 hour, 3 hour with commercial breaks special that aired on Sunday night by the time this goes up last week, almost a week ago on Sunday, which James, did you get a chance to sit down and watch most of in full? I mean, it's very long.
No, I did finally. It was a journey. It was 3 hours. And I feel a lot of people, I don't generally watch full Saturday Night Lives anymore because that's mm-hmm. what we have the internet for.
Yeah.
Everybody else can watch Saturday Night Live and kind of screen it for me. And then, if there is a particular, Lonely Planet or Lonely Island sketch that killed or whatever, I can just zoom in on that over the next day or two.
It is
Well, this was, I watched the entire thing, but how if you watch, a whole Saturday Night Live, it's sketch comedy and there will be, a couple of things that really kill, moments that you're glad that you saw, and then there's Weekend Update and then it just kind of goes on. Well, this was twice that. And that coupled with the fact that it kind of feels like we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the 50th anniversary at this point, of a show that already likes to celebrate itself a lot. It was just a lot. But, there was also a lot of, for me, kind of very sweet, reminiscence. There was a lot of old faces, a lot of people that it was more like, oh, they're on there. I did appreciate it. I did appreciate the sweep of history and characters that were in there.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting. There is not another show precisely like it in the history of television. I mean, you've got shows that have gone on for many years, of course. Most of them are new shows or, The Tonight Show, right? And you can draw some consistencies, some through lines through those. But SNL really is kind of unique in the sense that for 45 of the 50 years, it's been the brainchild of one guy, Lorne Michaels.
Yeah.
And he kind of rules it with, his iron fist. And that does, look, that creates a, that does create a sort of continuity, a sort of
it's my take on SNL in that sense is that it's not really a show anymore. It's been around too long to be that. It's like an institution or a university where like the current A students of American comedy go on and they stick around for a few years or 20 or whatever, and then move on to other things. But it's not a show in the sense that yes, Lorne Michaels has a style and an approach and certainly many philosophies about what do and don't work on his show, as he should. But when I think about And this is not even a dig at Saturday Night Live. I'm just describing sort of like what its purpose is, you know, kind of what it exists to be. When I think of like sketch comedy shows that I really love, you know, over the years, Monty Python, Kids in the Hall, Key and Peele, those are shows that are the product of a specific cast of specific writers. It has their sensibilities and their obsessions, you know, and themes that play out. Saturday Night Live obviously has been through so many eras and cast changeovers and so on that it can't really be like that. It's, you know, for me, it's sort of like a public utility now, you know?
It's interesting. You mentioned these other shows being kind of a specific cast of actors, specific group of writers for a specific sensibility, but they're also from a specific time period.
Yeah.
And that time limited period, you know, even if you mentioned Key and Peele, you know, Key and Peele is very much a sketch show about, amongst other things, but kind of about the Obama years, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that period of time. Inside Amy Schumer, you know, gets the kind of end of that and also the beginning of the Trump years.
Yeah.
Or the Chappelle Show, right, is like a kind of perfect encapsulation of, I don't know, early Bush.
Yeah, you're totally thinking of that time period when you think of it. Yeah.
Right. And SNL can't be that because, again, it's been on for 50 years. And I do think one of the interesting things about it is how it has changed from a show that really was about a very specific kind of moment in history and, you know, the mid-1970s and, you know, what was going on in the country and in New York City at the time, to now it is a show that is kind of about itself.
Yeah.
It's very self-conscious. It's always got the political cold open. It's always got, you know, newsy jokes, political jokes. And that, I do think that has, I don't know, my take on this is that it has diminished the show just a little bit by losing that sense of specific selfness and kind of becoming a more general institution.
Yeah, and you know, I think that it lost that a long time ago. Again, you know, it kind of had to once you got past the original cast and writers and so on. But it stuck around and stayed this colossus of TV. It became the show about whatever was big in the country and the culture at the time, you know, so, you know, and sort of the same things that make it a big deal or give it a loud voice also kind of make it impossible for it to be sort of idiosyncratic and, you know, distinctive anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you've had the experience, everybody's had the experience of you see something happen in the news and it's like, oh, I can't wait to see the SNL cold open about this. And like more often than not, like that will be the SNL cold open, unless something else like supplants it in buzz that week. And again, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's going to mean that this is a show that's never, you know, necessarily going to have more of an, it has individual voices within it. You know, there are performers who like have distinctive characters and sensibilities. But, you know, as a show, it's not necessarily going to have that much more of a voice than like a, you know, broadcast network news show or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that sounds, I mean, again, that is a good way to think of it as sort of a, you know, meet the press for comedy, which is, you know.
Not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. Like, it's never going to be one of my favorite shows for that reason. That's me. But it's like it's what it's for. It's serving its purpose now when it becomes that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. So you wrote a piece for The Times about your favorite season, your favorite episode of the show. And I'm fascinated by it because I feel like your experience with the show is a fairly archetypal experience with the show, where you know you get to it. But tell folks what you chose to focus on and what time of your life that was.
Yeah, I mean again, you know, I would not describe myself as an SNL fan or super fan, even as a TV critic. Maybe because I'm a TV critic, and there's so much that I have to sample, and I'm really more focused on what's new and interesting. What's there something new to say about? I don't follow it, you know, super closely. And there have been stretches of my life where I have watched it not at all. Like, I would say the 90s of SNL is like a, you know, just a blank, redacted space for me. But, you know, I think that I am basic in the sense that I feel like a lot of people have an individual personal SNL, which was the SNL that they watched at the time, and it was probably sometime when they were pretty young and started to be able to stay up for it or whatever, when they were ready for it and got really into it and their friends were into it and they would quote scenes to each other. This is not a new insight, you know, by the way, as I say in the piece, you know, Lorne Michael has, I think, often said, you know, if somebody tells me what they think the best Saturday Night Live cast is, I'll say, oh, well, that's when they were in high school. Mm. And in fact, I was in high school during Saturday Night Live's season 10, which is sort of the asterisk season of Saturday Night Live, in that not only was it during one of those years, as you mentioned, when Lorne was not with the show and it was Dick Ebersole producing, it had just experienced a big cast turnover. This was the 1984 to 1985 season. A bunch of big stars had left it. And Ebersole brings in, he's basically like George Steinbrenner opening his wallet or whatever. Like, he hires a bunch of comedy ringers, Billy Crystal, Martin Short, Christopher Guest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This was, you know, I had been watching Saturday Night Live before then, but it was just kind of the time when, you know, my friends would all talk about it in the lunchroom on Monday morning, and you know, I was very into it. So I decided to focus for this piece on one particular episode that has, it and the individual sketches in it have sprung into my mind over and over and over again over the years, to the point that in the days when you could not find episodes of Saturday Night Live online, my wife, who is an archivist, tracked it down through a contact and like we got a samizdat copy of it that we kind of, like, you know, just treasured like a rare artifact. And that was the you wouldn't really call it the Christmas special, but it was the pre-Christmas break episode in December 1984, when Eddie Murphy, which Saturday Night Live had made into a huge star and who had gone off to make Beverly Hills Cop, and nobody thought would ever come back, came back to guest host. And it, you know, it for me was just an episode where this particular cast and their strengths were firing on all cylinders. Obviously, it showcased Eddie Murphy, who's at the peak of his talent at that point in a lot of ways. If you recall the, I think, relatively famous White Like Me film that he did. Yep. Which was a parody of the book and documentary from the 60s, Black Like Me, where he goes undercover in whiteface and a Ned Flanders mustache and exposes the secret truths about how white people treat each other when they're alone. Anyway, hilarious. You should go back and watch it. I can't do it justice. Find it on YouTube. But yeah, it was one banger after another. And more and more often when I think about that, you know, when I think about Saturday Night Live, that's what I think of. I think of, you know, Martin Short playing a World War II GI who grew up in Nebraska and doesn't know how to climb stairs, trying to climb a flight of stairs. You know, I think about, you know, Gumby and his, you know, ultra-cocker cronies hanging out at Lishman's Deli, arguing about what is a Maury Amsterdam sandwich. You know, just for me, you know, because, you know, when you love something like this, you really sort of, you know, you love your youth. Like that's the time in Saturday Night Live and my relationship to it that like I always personally treasure.
I do. It is so funny because it is 100% true that, you know, the moment of SNL that is the favorite for almost everybody is that high school 16 to 20, say. Let's throw that those age ranges out there. And it's 100% true for me as well. I mean, that for me, that was the 90s. That was the back half of the 90s and early 2000s, you know, from
so Will Ferrell,
you know, Anna Gasteyer, Molly Shannon, Chris Kattan, that crew, but also, you know, the Norm Macdonald Weekend Update.
Yes.
Into the Colin Quinn years. And then it is fascinating to look back at some of this stuff. You know, I mentioned the specials that Peacock is doing, and there are a billion of them. But one of them is very specifically looking at the making of the More Cowbell sketch. You know, Will Ferrell playing the cowbell during
Christopher Walken.
With Christopher Walken. They're taping. They're recording. Don't Fear the Reaper. Whatever. Everyone's seen the sketch as this. Documentary makes clear, but it is that product of a very specific age and memory, and remembering watching that with my friends and, you know, rolling around on the floor laughing at it. The one thing these documentaries really get at, and this is, I think, something the special, the 3-hour again episode of you know, on a Sunday, weirdly, of Saturday Night Live, really gets at, is the logistics of the show. The show, more than anything else, is a triumph of logistics. Writing, planning, building the sets for, you know, getting all the talent there, doing an entire 90-minute show in the course of about 4 days every week is a real triumph. And doing, in, I assume they had more time to plan this, you know, 50th anniversary special, but still, like, just watching them move people, move very famous and, you know, talented people on and off the stage for 3 straight hours is a real, is like kind of a perfect encapsulation of what that show is.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I don't want to wear this, you know, beat this to death, but, you know, as I said, like, I've never considered myself a SNL super fan. I will say that watching, and I've not watched the 5,000 documentaries that Peacock produced, but, you know, I've watched a fair amount of the anniversary prep, and also, you know, pieces that have been done in other media around the anniversary. And I found that I do kind of have this, like, reservoir of affection for the show that I didn't really realize I have. And I think part of it is that kind of, like, just that theater kid thing of, you know, it is just, it's kind of, you know, inspiring and impressive to watch these creative people under a tremendous amount of stress, you know, to mount this, you know, this very difficult thing week after week after week.
Yeah, it really is. It's something else. Again, there's this one documentary in particular that's about it's a week in the writer's room of the show. And it's really fascinating because it gets into, as a writer, I will say writers are often underappreciated. Right. It's totally true. But that's kind of the undercurrent of it. But really what the documentary is about is the actual physical production of the show, the actual, you know, not just the table reads, not just the pitch sessions, not the sitting down and writing the scripts, because you can only show that for so much time on TV anyway before viewers tune out. But it's the building of the sets, it's the making of the costumes, it's the special effects guys who have to make, you know, whatever the heads people wear and the, you know, exploding bodies that are thrown all over the stage. It's fascinating. It's just a fascinating TikTok look. If I could recommend any one of those to folks, I would recommend that one because it is interesting.
We don't have that much live theater on television anymore since the 50s, you know, and it is, you know, kind of a holdover. I mean, it's a holdover a lot of things. Like, it's kind of like a variety show, you know. It's not really like Ed Sullivan, but it sort of occupies some of the sort of place in the culture that, you know, the Ed Sullivan show did. And yeah, that energy of theater and production kind of exists there in a way that, you know, it doesn't so much in, you know, the highly produced but differently produced, you know, scripted and reality TV of today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder, you know, it's funny, yeah. not to sidetrack us too much, but, you know, we were talking about how we each have affection for our particular eras of Saturday Night Live. And I don't know that much about, like, the young people of today, you know, but I do wonder if that is the same as it used to be, because, like, I'm always, like, I'm a big believer that the mechanics of TV changes both the form of TV and the reception of TV. And, you know, like we were saying, for us, it was partly a function of, okay, you're old enough to stay up and watch a whole Saturday Night Live now. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, when you're streaming things, watching YouTube clips, you know, whatever, you know, I honestly just don't know if the Gen Z audience of Saturday Night Live, to the extent that it exists, is forming either the same kind of identification, or if they're doing it at the same time in their lives as we did.
Yeah, no, the sense I get, and I am by no means an expert on this, but the sense I get is that it is primarily a YouTube channel at this point, or a TikTok channel, I guess. But it is primarily a YouTube channel that folks share the next day, and I do think that changes. That has to change the relationship someone has to the show. I mean, I just don't understand. I don't think you could watch it like any other piece of YouTube content and still come away with this idea of being a fan of Saturday Night Live. It's just another piece of content.
For me, it's way more efficient as a viewer, but mm-hmm. I have to imagine, you know, now Saturday Night Live is competing with every other piece of short form comedy, you know, like whatever, mm-hmm. you know, humorous satirical monologue somebody's doing on, you know, TikTok or Reels or whatever. And part of, you know, to speak really broadly, I feel like part of the experience of developing SNL fandom was kind of, you know, was the physical experience of it, you know, being built into your week and a thing that you would do on Saturday Night Live or whatever. And knowing its rhythms, sitting through the crappy stuff, you know, watching it through, you know, the uninspiring Weekend Update or the late in the show sketches or whatever, you know, and you're obviously you are getting a higher ratio of bangers watching it the way that, you know, we watch it now.
But maybe you can't imprint
the same way that you could. Yeah, exactly.
No, totally. I think that's totally true. I think that's, it is, again, you mentioned how you watch things changes how those things exist. And this has always been, I think, an underappreciated part of the TV revolution. I think there's a whole book to be written about the way TiVo, which led to DVRs and kind of destroyed the advertising market, on basic cable, I think there's a whole book to be written about how that change in audience behavior, both in terms of, again, skipping the ads, but also time shifting, binging, et cetera, like all of these kind of lead to an entirely different world of television that is experienced in a different way that does not track to how I certainly watched Saturday Night Live in 1998 in my basement. You know, it's just different. But that's maybe a piece for another time. I don't know. The one last thing I just want to highlight is, you mentioned the reservoir of affection for the show, and the moment that really hit me watching this, you know, again, after the fact without commercials, you know, able to pause and rewind or fast forward if I needed to, was the Adam Sandler song. He does one of his songs that is both. I found it tremendously moving, not just because of the, you know, the references to Chris Farley and Norm Macdonald, who have died and who he was good friends with, but the way he put together a song that is both very specific and aimed at the people who worked on the show, but could also be appreciated by the broader audience by referencing cast members and skits that audiences knew and loved. I found tremendously moving to a surprising extent. Like, I got slightly teary at the end. And I was not expecting that, because I'm kind of cynical and jaded about SNL, right? Like, oh, SNL, it is what. But I found myself. I found myself really deeply moved by that, and I don't know what it was. I don't know. I assume you were not moved to tears by it as I was, but if that hit you as well.
Not as deeply, but I know what you mean. I also didn't hate it the way I might have predicted in advance that I would. I talked earlier about how, I kind of drifted away from SNL, and the 90s was a big, hole for me. I mean, a big part of that was that was the Adam Sandler era. And, mm-hmm. I was not the world's biggest Opera Man fan, et cetera, et cetera. but also, Sandler, just more broadly beyond SNL, he's kind of changed in his dad era. I kind of feel, you said, I did not expect to, feel moved this much by an Adam Sandler song. I feel like kind of... The whole so many sentences about Adam Sandler, in the recent years have been, I didn't expect to feel X, Y, and Z about an Adam Sandler performance, whether it's Uncut Gems or whatever, I do think he's been able to, he's able to tap into this certain sense of warmth, and he comes at it from the inside, but he's able to bring the audience into it. And, Tony Soprano famously told us that, remember when is the lowest form of conversation, and certainly the song, the whole 3-hour special was a lot of remember when, but that was probably the highest form of the lowest form of conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. The highest form of the lowest form. I found it surprisingly moving. I was cynical. Me got moved by it. One last thought on SNL. How long can this show go on? Has it created its own sort of perpetual motion? Do we think this lasts forever? Does it last past Lorne dying or stepping down or whatever? I am. It's the sort of show. It's been on literally longer than I've been alive.
Yeah.
So I cannot imagine a world without Saturday Night Live. But it can't go forever, can it? Nothing lasts forever.
I think it can, because if nothing else, it's a brand. It might someday become totally abstracted from the TV show and become purely a streaming channel or something like that. But the transition from Lorne, whenever it happens, will be interesting, but it has existed without Lorne before. I just feel it's one of those things now. It's 60 mm-hmm. Minutes. It's Time Magazine. Mm-hmm. It's just it's a stamp on the things that happened that week. And my guess is, number one... A network that creates this many documentaries about its show turning 50 is not interested in letting go of that show anytime soon.
Yeah.
I feel that it will exist as long as there's TV, and even if TV is something very different.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of TV, I want to talk a little bit about Audience of One, Donald Trump television and the fracturing of America, because I was rereading it, and there's this passage early on. I'm gonna pull it up here real quick so I don't botch it here. I'm just gonna read. I'm gonna read this passage. It's pretty short. Just hold on, folks at home. Quote: "The journey of Donald Trump from least objectionable program in 1980 to most objectionable program in 2016, when he won as very much the kind of personality he said could never be elected in Reagan's time, is in part the story of the disintegration of the mass media audience," end quote. And I think this is the key way to understand how television has evolved and how Donald Trump has taken advantage of it, because he has captured the angry cohort. He has managed to get the people who are angry, but in so doing has also kind of weaponized anger against him. And this is what I mean when I say this. The other day on Twitter, I was talking about how nobody wants to be seen as the scold, right? Nobody wants to be seen as the school marm saying, "No, don't joke about that. That's not funny. You can't do that." It is a defeating position. It always comes back to haunt you. Nobody wants to be seen as the school marm scold. And one of Donald Trump's superpowers, I say this, you know, tongue firmly in cheek, but one of his superpowers is to be able to turn everybody who opposes him into that scold, right? Yeah. Like he has mastered the ability to do and say outrageous things, like declare himself king of Manhattan. You know, I'm getting rid of the tolls, the congestion tolls. I'm the king. And like, it is so frustrating to me, because I don't want to sit there being the guy saying, "Don't do that. Don't call yourself a king." But also, yeah, he shouldn't be doing that. How do people avoid falling into that trap? How do you avoid being the guy who's yelling at your TV at home, right? How do you not do that?
I wish I had thought of this for my book. This was not my coinage, but my friend Emily Nussbaum, was the TV critic, now a writer for The New Yorker, wrote a piece about Trump's use of humor, or like, you know, jokes, jokes or jokes with air quotes around. And she called it a Chinese finger trap. You know, the those little things you put around your finger, and the more you struggle to get out of it, the tighter it gets. And that's, you know, and it has that quicksand effect where, you know, the more you fight against the outrageousness or absurdity or the trolling, the more that you benefit it by becoming, you know, you become Marge Simpson trying to cancel Itchy and Scratchy. I think in part that, you know, one either needs to ignore the behavior, or not ignore the behavior, but, you know, focus on the principle, you know, whether it is that, you know, actually we don't have kings in you know, America and shouldn't have kings, or you find a way to generate other content, you know, to treat what is ridiculous as ridiculous, but in a way that, you know, that satirizes it or makes a counter argument. You know, because yes, obviously, if you approach anything like that with, you know, from sort of the standpoint, you become like the, you know, scold is a good term for it, but it's also almost like you become the, you know, I forget, you know, the woman's name. But you're like the haughty lady in the Marx Brothers movie, right? Exists there to be the butt of the joke by being outraged by the joke. You know, and it's a tough trap. It's why you've seen like why comedy has used that for decades and hundreds of years.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too, because it did sustain an entire media television in particular ecosystem in the 2017 to 2021 range where, or I mean, really like 2015 to 2021 range where Donald Trump would say something crazy. Fox News would kind of gleefully repeat it. And then MSNBC and CNN, to a lesser extent, would be like, he can't say that. And everybody benefited from this at the time. Everybody benefited from this. This was it was a huge boon for television ratings throughout this again, this micro-targeting, this breakdown of the mass culture to the micro-culture, where you could have the people who are very into it and the people who are very opposed to it. And everybody got something out of it. And I do think... I'm curious if you think that now that has broken down. It seems like that has broken down a little bit in this current era. I don't think we are going to have explicitly a repeat of that, and certainly not on cable news. You're seeing a little more of it in social media, though.
You know, I think in the same sense that CNN gradually learned that it wasn't the most informative thing to run every Trump rally live and show his empty podium like they did in 2015 and 2016. It took them a few years, but they got that. I think you're seeing some sort of dawning awareness in, cable news, at least, not to chase every shiny object. But it's tough. Because not just because of the specific nature of Donald Trump, but because the nature of cable news is, A, it's to chase shiny objects. Also, it's to fill up 24 hours a day. So shiny objects are a gift for you. To get back to what you were saying earlier and even saying about Saturday Night Live and the way that TiVo and streaming and changes in the way that, we experience media have changed all of us. Audience of One, I thought of it as a couple of different things. It's, a book about media and politics, but it's not mainly a political book. It's sort of written, chronologically like autobiography, but it's not an autobiography of Donald Trump. It's a biography of the character that he's played in the media since 1980, roughly.
Yeah.
But it is also, I feel like the other parallel track besides Trump, because, the subtitle is Donald Trump Television and the Fracturing of America. Part of that fracturing is media fragmentation. And it is sort of an arc of media over the past 70 years from the mid 20th century to the present, when we went from this period when there was, a monoculture, when there were three broadcast networks, when a lot of Americans experienced the same things at the same time, to a point when you had people watching their particular favorite, cable channels, or curating their own social media feeds and so on. And a lot of it talks about how a lot of the phenomenon that created Donald Trump were phenomena of the atomization of media. And, one thing that, I don't want to romanticize the kind of, homogeneous monocultural media of the mid 20th century. But if you had these events unfolding, in 1972 or whatever happened over the day would happen over the day, over the course of the day. And then Walter Cronkite would, give the gist of this for a half hour on CBS, and 70 million people of all sorts of different, whatever the figure was, of all sorts of different political beliefs and backgrounds would, absorb this and take whatever they could from it. But now you have not only different partisan media, cable channels from different, and outlets from different political points of view covering all of this, but they're covering it all the time. And it rewards somebody who is willing to keep throwing just, chum into the water all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, excited to do this another four more years. It's going to be great. I really, if you, it, it the book is great, and folks should pick it up. Again, it's Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America. I think it's a very helpful primer to kind of understand how we got here. So folks should check it out. It's available on Amazon, wherever you buy books. Do yourself a favor and pick it up. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know about SNL or your relationship to it, or Donald Trump and the fracturing of America. I don't what did we not discuss that we should have?
You know, just going back to SNL, I will say in the deluge of SNL content that we've been exposed to over the past few months, one thing that I did really enjoy, I don't know if you saw this, I don't know if you felt the same about it, was the Questlove documentary on the music of Saturday Night Live. Number one, because I think like whatever, you know, Questlove's like strengths and weaknesses as a documentarian, he's so good at editing and, you know, using the language of video and sound to tell a story. So it's just really impressively made. If you haven't seen it yet, there's this great opening sequence where he edits together snippets of different interviews into like almost kind of a rap, like a song. But also, you know, it's interesting because if, you know, as we've said, SNL kind of, you know, often does the things that you expect it to do in a lot of ways because it has its pattern and its obligations and whatever, you know, the music over the years has kind of been one area in which things could go any way, you know, whether it was, you know, Sinead O'Connor, Ashley Simpson, you know, or whatever. And this was the thing where I went into that documentary thinking, oh, this, you know, it'll be kind of fun to remember all this stuff, but is there really a whole film in this? And it ended up seeming like a kind of, you know, to me, a pretty interesting, you know, kind of cultural arc of, you know, American music and pop culture from the mid 70s through today. So, I would say if you must see one more piece of Saturday Night Live 50th anniversary content, I would suggest that one.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I was thinking we haven't really talked about music at all, and that is a huge part of the show. I mean, from the very beginning, this is a highlighting the new pop acts out there. For folks,
and to come full circle on everything that we've talked about, I do not recall. I may have blinked and missed it. Whether the 3-hour 50th anniversary special in any way commemorated 2004 and 2015 guest host Donald Trump?
I think he was conspicuously absent from a lot of those. I don't think Elon Musk got much of a mention either. Neither was invited to the star-studded show itself, which just looking at the crowd of that show is hilarious. You know, Kevin Costner next to, I don't know, Jenna Ortega or whoever, like they're all next to, you know, Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively two rows down next to, I mean, it's crazy. It's something.
It was a motley assemblage. There were a lot of interesting pairings. I mean, from, you know, Sabrina Carpenter and Paul Simon at the beginning on through.
Yeah. Well, James, thank you very much for being on the show. I'm glad I finally got somebody on to talk about SNL. It's an institution. We need to celebrate it while it's.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun to talk about.
All right. And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.